Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, February 20th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today, and we welcome back Dr. Valerie Rapson. If you have a question about the heavens, or perhaps the impending city killer asteroid that's going to hit the Earth and cause mayhem in a few years, you might want to call 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Yes, my friends, the end is nigh. Get your calls in while you can. 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson is with us today to answer your questions. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. We'll be right back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're talking astronomy today. We welcome Dr. Valerie Rapson, Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in Astrophysical Science and Technology at RIT. If you have a question about space, the final frontier, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, or, again, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Dr. Valerie Rapson, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. How are you?
How are things at the college?
They're going great. We're, you know, almost in the middle of the semester now. The first tests are this week. So, you know, yesterday was a little nerve-wracking for my students, just kind of getting ready. But yeah. I think they're all good to go. I hope I prepared them well.
So they're good students.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
What's the craziest excuse you got from a college kid so far that says, I can't be at class because?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, lately they've just all been sick, which is genuine. You know, the flu's going around. I was sick a couple weeks ago. But, you know, they haven't told me anything too crazy yet. I got to give them credit for that.
You know, in the old, when you're in school, elementary school, middle school, high school, you have to have a note from mm-hmm. mom or dad to if you're ill. These are college kids. How do you check on them? Do you have to go and say, well, listen, let's see the doctor's note?
Well, here's my thing. You know, them getting a good education is on them. If they want to show up to class, great. That's what they're supposed to do. That's how they're going to learn. If they don't want to show up to class, I can't make them. And if they tell me they're sick, I trust them. So I try and, you know, treat them like adults and put it on them. If they want to get their education, they should show up. And if they're sick, take a break and, you know, don't come in and get me sick. So I'm happy with that. But I don't ask them for doctor's notes or anything. We got to trust them and treat them like adults.
How's your health, by the way?
I'm okay.
Okay,
I'm
good. Because, okay. I mean, we're fairly close to studio away, so I want to make sure.
A couple of weeks ago, I was not very good, but thankfully it wasn't a radio show day for me.
You know, do you remember the old days of the COVID when everybody mm-hmm. was on the phone? Boy, that was tough. I'm so glad you're back in person. The number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. All right, now listen there, Dr. Rapson.
Uh-oh.
This is from the New York Post only mm-hmm. a day ago. Today's the 20th, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday this came out, 19th of February. Odds of city killer asteroid hitting Earth increase again, hitting historic milestone.
Yes.
I'm scared to death. The odds that a city killer asteroid, 2024 YR4, will strike our planet just increased again. NASA recently raised the probability of deep impact to 1 in 32, mm-hmm. or 3.1%. That's according to latest data from the Center for Near-Earth Object Studies. Been 24 hours. Is it getting any worse?
Well, you could take a breath because it's actually getting a lot better.
Oh, good.
In the last 24 hours, the probability has shrunk from 3.1% down to 0.28%. I just refreshed the page on my phone to check
because
it's changed three times today already. But, you know, we're down to less than a percent chance hitting us now.
All right. That's good news. Mm-hmm. Explain to me how they calculate these percentages and how they're watching this thing and how far away is it?
Yeah, definitely. So it was, first of all, it was discovered back in December when it kind of came in towards the sun and it got bright enough to see. It has since looped around the sun, passed by Earth, and now it's, you know, heading to the outer solar system for a little bit. And what we're doing is from all these different large observatories on Earth, we're taking pictures, we're tracking its motion against the background stars, and that's what allows us to figure out its path. And the more observations we make, the more we can constrain exactly how it's orbiting the sun. And that's why things keep changing. There's almost 400 observations now, and putting them all together allows us to get a more accurate 3D map of how it's going to come back around in a few years.
When this first hit, and I think it was just discovered, what, in December?
Yeah, just like 2 months ago.
You know, there was fear that, okay, we've tried this satellite, I should say asteroid nudging project, mm-hmm, and it was somewhat successful,
yeah,
I guess. But it's too late to get a launch ready now because this thing is going to be here in 6 years.
Right.
Or seven. And so, you know, there was reason to be somewhat scared. Nothing we can really do about it either way.
Right, yeah.
If you can't nudge it, what else could you do?
Yeah, well, it is going to come back around in 2028, so we have a better chance of observing it. And if there was something that we could dream up in the next couple of years, we could definitely do it then because it'll be closer and we can, you know, push it out of the way a little bit. But right now, I don't think we have to worry about it. We could try and, you know, send a little spacecraft up and not hit it and push it out of the way, but even just maneuvering something next to it could be like enough of a nudge. That little gravitational influence could push it out of the way just enough so it doesn't hit us. So there are options if we need them, but I think we're going to be okay.
Okay, fair enough. But, you know, they nudged this. How long ago did they do that?
The DART mission?
Yeah,
like 1 or 2 years ago now.
So, and successful. But if something was really imminent, if it was a 75% chance and
right,
it was coming, why couldn't you just fire up a nuke on a missile and just vaporize the whole thing? I've read that that doesn't work. And why wouldn't it work?
Right. Well, it's not that we can't blow it up, basically. I mean, even this DART mission where we, you know, pushed the moon of the little asteroid, when we hit, it caused all this debris to come up. So we did destroy the moon a little bit orbiting the asteroid. But the issue is if you blow up the asteroid headed towards Earth, you've turned one large problem into 1,000 little problems. So maybe the main global killing asteroid doesn't hit us, but we are still going to get hit with the debris. And we have no way of controlling where that's going to go. So we don't want to accidentally wipe out a couple of cities. So,
well, wouldn't a hydrogen bomb vaporize everything if you had a direct hit?
I don't know. It depends on how big and, you know, whether the asteroid is more metallic or rocky. Like, it depends on so many factors. And we've only done the one experiment with another asteroid. So it's hard to know for sure. And we don't want to take too many chances.
All right. Well, while we're on this topic, and you sent, so I brought that histrionic headline to the fore, but you brought some articles. But before we get to those, this email is germane to the topic we're discussing.
Sure.
This is from Don in Amsterdam. On Friday the 13th, April 13th, 2029, Apophis has a 2.7% chance of hitting Earth at the speed of 10 miles per second. If it misses Earth, how close will it be on its next rotation 7 years from now? Caveat here, I looked it up, and I don't think it's 2.7%.
Yeah, it's not as high as it used to be. It's far, far less than 1% now. It used to be high, and the issue is this. When these objects first come by, we have, you know, 3, 4, 5 observations, and we really don't have the path of the asteroids constrained. But once we have hundreds of observations, we can figure out that they're actually going to pass very safely by, many times past the distance to the moon. So Apophis was just like this one. It came in, it was almost 3% chance of hitting us in the beginning, but after many more observations, we now know that it's going to be much further away from the Earth than we originally thought. So that one has even less of a chance of hitting us than this new one.
But Don's second part of that question, I think, is really interesting. Assuming it misses Earth, how close will it be on its next rotation? And we can throw that one back to the one that we were talking about earlier. How do you reliably predict the next go round.
Yeah. Well, you have to keep watching it. That's the key. You know, I can make all the observations I want today. And like the current asteroid, for example, the path that it might take is somewhere between like 1.5 times the Earth moon distance from one side of the Earth to the other. That's kind of the span that it might take.
Yeah.
And that's very common for asteroids like Apophis as well. But we have to keep watching it because every time they go around the sun, they're going past other things. Their orbits are changing slightly. So right now, Apophis is not going to hit us, but it may encounter something we don't know about, change its path, and then it might become more dangerous. So we have this long list of things that we're always observing for this reason, and the numbers keep updating.
So YR4, 2024 YR4, mm-hmm. the odds have been going down. In 24 hours, they went down a lot.
Yeah.
But the scary thing about this to me is it was only discovered a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
What else is out there, and where are they coming from?
Right. It's funny that you mentioned that, because we talked about this in my astronomy class about a week ago, and somebody raised their hand and asked exactly that, and they were like, you know, when did it get discovered? And I was like, oh, just a few weeks ago, and they all gasped.
Yeah.
You know, because it's scary. But the issue is these objects are small. You know, this asteroid's only about 200 feet wide, give or take, as best
it's
we can tell.
It's a city killer. It's a Tunguska. Right. 1908 size.
Sure. So it's small on the scale of asteroids, but big on the scale of, like, if it hits Earth, how much damage can it do?
Right.
But being only a few hundred feet, it doesn't glow by itself. It doesn't reflect a lot of sunlight. It's not very hot. So we have to wait for these asteroids to get essentially on top of us before we have a chance of seeing them with most of our telescopes.
Now I'm going to show you little fragmentary knowledge I have of astronomy, which is invariably wrong. So there's this thing, the Oort cloud out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, mainly comets that are out in the Oort cloud?
We think so, yeah, mostly icy objects.
Okay,
yeah.
And how far away is that from, how many astronomical units away?
Yeah, that's far. That's, you know, more than half the distance to the nearest star. So we're talking about, you know, a couple light years away.
Are these things coming from, ultimately, from the Oort cloud, or is the Oort cloud just basically there?
Well, the Oort cloud is there, and we think that a lot of our, like, long-period comets, the comets that come in and then come back hundreds of years later, they probably come from the Oort cloud. These asteroids can come from anywhere. They may have been floating around the solar system, and then this is just the first time that they happen to pass close enough to Earth.
Mm.
This one probably didn't come from the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. That one, it's too close. We would have seen it by now. But there's asteroids that, you know, go out to Uranus or Neptune and then come back in. So this asteroid may have been floating around for a long time, and we just didn't catch it until now. We don't really know exactly where it came from.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. We'll get to the call shortly. We have a couple more things to bring up here, but let's take a break now. Young Kalen McPherson is our board op and our engineer today.
Mm.
So at this time, Kalen, I'm going to give you a nod, and you hit that music there, son. Go ahead, give it a shot, and I'll say something like this. It's Vox Pop. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be back. I hear a rhapsody that Doug Sertl on the trombone there. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Ray Graff with you on a Vox Pop that features Dr. Valerie Rapson. All right, Val, let's do a couple of things that you sent, a couple of topics, and then we'll hit the phones. The Ring Nebula is a barrel, not a ring. And this is from Sky and Telescope. And I got to say, this is fascinating. One of the astronomers that they quote in this article was your PhD, Shepard.
Yeah, Dr. Joel Kastner, yep.
It's very cool. So when they look at these things like these nebulae, they're really looking at hot gases, right, generally.
Yeah.
But this is different.
Yeah, so this is talking about the Ring Nebula, which many people have seen through small telescopes. It's right in the summertime sky in the middle of Lyra. It's that classic, you know, colorful ring that we see. And what they did here is they traced carbon monoxide using radio telescopes. This is a common thing that we do because carbon monoxide traces where the hydrogen is. And with the radio telescope technique, they can actually see how the gas is moving.
Yeah.
So they can use the Doppler effect, see how it's kind of maneuvering around, and create this 3D model in like a velocity velocity space. So now we have the highest resolution 3D model ever, and it shows us that it's shaped more like a barrel, and we're looking down the top of an open barrel.
What are the odds that we'd be looking down the right? the ring and right. think, okay, well, it's just a donut out there, but yeah. in fact, it's more like a rugby ball.
Yeah.
And we have the perfect vantage mm-hmm. not to see the fact that it's this huge item yeah. out in space. So what does this tell us about formations of, okay, nebula, and I might be wrong, mm-hmm. it's a star that is, our sun will do this at some mm-hmm. point,
yes.
right? It just sheds stuff.
Yes.
How many years do we have left?
We've got about 6-7 billion oh. total before this is going to happen.
Oh, good.
So we got a ways to go.
Hopefully I'll be retired by then. So the carbon is interesting, though. And mm-hmm. it was surprising, the outgassing, is that right, of the carbon?
Yeah, so they were looking towards the very center. You know, now that we know we're looking down a barrel, we can see that there's some, like, jets, and there's some carbon that's moving towards and away from us. And it's actually a little bit offset. So we are looking straight down the barrel, but the gases are not coming straight back out at us. They're tipped a little bit. And that tells us that there's actually probably two stars in the center.
And is this new, or were people hypothesizing
yeah,
this?
Yeah, so my PhD advisor's been working on planetary nebula for ages. And he's always said that, you know, they have funny shapes. Some of them are circular and some of them are very much not.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to explain these unique shapes is to say, okay, well, one star essentially explodes and pushes that plasma out. And then if there's a second star there that orbits around, it's going to kind of manipulate the material and push it in different directions. So that's why we get these funny shapes.
So did they both basically go belly up, both of these stars at the same time? Or did one go nebula or whatever it does, whatever the red giant and then whatever happens?
Mm-hmm.
But did they both follow the same timeline?
They probably follow very different timelines, and it's unclear because we can only see like the one white dwarf in the center. We haven't really detected the second one, I don't believe. So we are just speculating that it must be there based on the tilt and the shapes that we see. So it may be a white dwarf that had exploded first and has just cooled off to the point where we can't see it.
Oh, interesting.
Or maybe it's just kind of too small and cold generally to see. So this is just kind of showing that these nebula that look simple, they look like a boring, simple circle in the sky, are actually way more dynamic and interesting than we originally thought.
When you astrophysicists go to cocktail parties, is it all this chit-chat, and do you guys find it exciting?
Yes, pretty much.
No.
Although I have a rule, after about 9 o'clock, I don't talk any more math. Like,
really?
We can talk concepts, but my mathematical brain just shuts off about that
I would
time.
Think two martinis, too, would probably
yeah, right?
be the...
Not doing math very well after that, that's for sure.
All right, we're going to go to Mark and Gardner in a minute, but quickly, let's talk about news from the Webb Telescope. This is from Webb Telescope. Webb reveals rapid-fire light show from our Milky Way's central black hole.
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal with that?
Yeah, this is pretty cool. So, you know, James Webb is looking at everything, including towards the black hole. We can't actually see it with James Webb, but we can see basically all the hot plasma that's swirling around it. And when they observed it recently, they noticed that it kind of flickered.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, they'd have these long, bright flashes. And they've been trying to figure out what they are. And the theory is that as the plasma kind of orbits around the black hole...
This
and it
is
will,
close to the black hole.
Yeah, it will ultimately fall in. You're basically getting little high-density pockets. And as those, you know, pockets get really warm and packed together, they might flash this high energy.
And these are magnetic fields that are basically banging into each
other?
Well,
the magnetic fields are the second piece. The short one is basically the material kind of compressing and smushing together and glowing. But there's this magnetic reconnection, kind of like if you imagine two magnets that snap together.
Yeah.
It's essentially that kind of thing. And when that happens, that creates a much brighter flash of light. And it's going to help us ultimately understand the dynamics of magnetic fields in what we call accretion disks, the disk of material that will eventually fall into or at least be near the supermassive black holes.
You know, I never thought of this, but hearing you describe it, if I had two magnets, sizable ones, good size refrigerator magnets mm-hmm. that are strong, and we banged them together, could you measure an energy output from those two hitting each other?
Sure, if you had the right equipment.
So interesting. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Mark is in Gardner. Mark, you're on.
Okay. I have read a number of times that if a probe or a rocket ship is launched, let's say, to Mars or to some of the outer planets, that a year or so later, it's not like halfway on its journey, it's been going around the sun and it passes close to the Earth once again. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the gravitational pull of the Earth acts as a slingshot to increase its forward speed. Mm-hmm. And the question, it has always seemed to me that any increase in forward speed caused by the gravitational pull of the Earth as the rocket ship passes the Earth would be canceled out by the drag of the gravitational force of the Earth slowing it down as it's moving away. And I don't understand why there would be a net gain in forward speed.
Mm. So it really just lies in, you know, exactly how close you get. That gravity pulls you in and essentially transfers some of the momentum to the object. And if you increase that speed, you are moving fast enough away, which ultimately counteracts the forces that are pulled back by gravity. So it's just kind of a whether you transfer the momentum efficiently enough to kind of overcome those, what you're calling drag forces pulling back.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of a balance
of
math.
It seems like it goes against the, the principle of the conservation of energy, that there's somehow a net gain in energy. And I still don't understand why that would be, fundamental reason why that would be.
Yeah, I mean, it's a net gain in energy for the object that's flying around, which is technically pulling a very minute amount of energy and momentum away from the Earth. So if you imagine, let's say, another Earth-sized object were to pass by, that would have a strong effect on our motion around the sun, our spin, all of that. But these satellites and spacecrafts are so small that even if they're taking essentially a little bit of energy from the Earth, that really doesn't have any visible effect.
Oh, it's not going to slow down the Earth in its orbit. What I'm saying is that this rocket ship, as it passes the Earth,
yes,
having increased its forward speed from the Earth's gravitational pull, as it passes the Earth and is moving now away, the Earth's gravitational pull would slow it down. It would seem to me would slow it down the same amount as it speeded up as it was approaching the Earth.
Right. Yeah. No. It's because it does kind of take some of the energy away from the Earth with it, and it is able to keep going.
All right, Mark. Thanks a lot. Well, I mean, wasn't that one of the things that tipped off Ari Loeb when that thing came from outside our? It was interstellar, basically. Mm-hmm. Whatever that thing, Muamua.
Yeah.
So it sped up on its own, right?
Right.
There was no slingshot effect there.
Yeah, there appeared to be a small slingshot effect, but the object, slowed down initially, and then all of a sudden it did speed up
again. And so
again.
Do we know why yet?
Well, we think it was some sort of outgassing. If this was like an icy object where, you get to the inner solar system, you melt some ices and the gases can be forced out, that would give a little boost, almost like turning thrusters on a rocket.
Ah.
But we don't know for sure, but that's, the leading theory for that object.
All right, let's go to Mark and Russell. Mark, you're on with Dr. Valerie Rapson.
Hi. A couple years ago, I read a science fiction book, a speculative fiction book, however you want to look at it, that talked about a meteor hitting the moon, not Earth, and I guess destroying the moon and the pieces of the moon hitting the Earth. It was a rather large book, and I don't remember all of it. But I guess my question is, are we monitoring at all objects that could hit the moon?
Yes, definitely. So this asteroid we were talking about at the beginning of the show has an even smaller chance of hitting the moon, but the path actually does cross the Earth, and the probability crosses the moon's path as well. So we are tracking this one and others for both of those predictions. But the moon's a little trickier because we also have to include its orbit around the Earth as well as its joint orbit around the sun with us. So it's a little more complicated to put all those pieces together.
All right, Mark.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, I thought I read that Apophis, that's how they say it?
Yeah.
Apophis is going to pass 20,000 miles from the Earth, which is inside the orbit of some of these satellites,
sure.
Right?
Yes. That makes it particularly dangerous because, there's a plus or minus error bar on that as well. So if it happens to pass like right at geosynchronous, which I think is like 22,000 miles or something like that, then we're in trouble.
Back to the Stone Age?
Yeah, well, at least from a satellite perspective, maybe.
I always loved the Flintstones anyway. Let's go to Penny in North Greenbush. Penny, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Last night, I observed four star-like no, six star-like lights in the sky. They were in a straight line, and they were equidistant.
Yeah. We know.
Oh, you do?
Well, no, we have a good guess. I mean, we weren't there, so we don't know. But a lot
of
people...
Yeah, they were in the western sky.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people see
about
these.
7 o'clock.
That's perfect timing, too, because, Penny, it's perfect timing. Valerie will tell you more. She's the guest.
Yeah, so when these satellites go up, they end up forming a straight line until they ultimately disperse. But very, you know, early evening and early morning.
Starlinks, you
Yeah,
mean.
The Starlink satellites, you know, they're very easy to see because they're catching the sun as it's setting. So they're a little bit more bright than usual. So if you're seeing something kind of going in a straight line in the west shortly after sunset, then it's definitely a set of satellites.
Yeah, and you know what, Penny?
Okay.
They talk about Starlink, which is Elon Musk's thing, but apparently there are several large concerns, aerospace concerns, that are putting constellations of satellites up, which must be a living hell for astronomers at certain times of day.
Yeah, we have totally talked about this before. Astronomers generally aren't happy, but at least now there are discussions amongst many countries and many space agencies where we're trying to come up with a game plan to track them all, to make sure that we know where they are, and also to mitigate the amount of light that they reflect back to Earth, because
right.
if they can go up there and essentially be invisible, that we can tolerate. It's when they're so bright and they create these streaks across our pictures that it's so frustrating.
And Penny, you said 7 mm-hmm. o'clock, right? You saw these?
It was about 7 o'clock, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so...
And they were...
Go ahead.
They seemed to be standing still.
Really? Standing still?
They should
yeah.
move very slowly. They could be high up, so they appeared to stand still for a few minutes, but they would, you know... Over time, they should definitely move across the sky.
It's pretty majestic to
yeah,
watch.
I presumed. I didn't watch them for very long.
Okay,
yeah.
There you go.
I went out in a very cold on a cold morning a couple months ago, and I was starting my car, and then I don't even have my coat on, and I'm standing out, and I counted 28 of these.
Oh my gosh!
They were close together, and I'm thinking, okay, I've been out here 5 minutes now.
Yeah.
I think it's time because it's 2 degrees.
Uh-huh,
so I went
uh-huh.
inside. But Penny, it's very interesting and good observation. Thanks for calling. 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. Carol writes, recently I was listening to WAMC. Don't remember which program. I heard an astronomer say that dark matter interacts with gravity but not with light. And that's why we know it's there but can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what this means and how it works? You have
yeah.
90 seconds.
Yeah,
go.
Right. No, we totally can. So dark matter is this mysterious stuff, but we believe that it is a physical type of matter and not just like an ambient energy or something like that, because
yeah.
it seems to interact gravitationally. The main observation is that if you look at stars at the edge of our galaxy and many other galaxies, they are orbiting at the same speed
yeah.
as the ones near the center. And our general physics laws say that if you're closer to the middle of the galaxy or closer to the middle of the solar system, you should orbit faster and objects at the edge should orbit slower, just like Mercury goes fast and Neptune goes slow.
Yeah.
But that's not what we observe in the galaxy. So what we think is happening is that there's extra dark matter, whatever this stuff is, at the edge of our galaxies that's essentially slowing the stars down increasing their speeds, I guess, to match the middle so that they go at the right speed. But they're affecting the speed of the star such that everything is orbiting at the same rate. And the only way we can do that is if there is gravity, material, pulling on other stars with gravity at the edge of our galaxy.
So all you can do is infer. We're not seeing anything directly.
Right. We're not seeing anything. We're not seeing a wall of darkness and saying that's where the dark matter
right.
is. We know that it must exist. And because it doesn't appear to interact with light, it doesn't block it. It doesn't emit. It doesn't do anything to it.
Yeah.
We have no way of mapping it with our regular telescopes because our telescopes can only see how light is manipulated by things in space.
Yes. Well, it was a little more than 90 seconds, but very well
but
done.
Too bad.
Dr. Valerie Rapson's our guest today. From SUNY Oneonta. Number's 800-348-2551. Let's go to Robert in Pauling. Hey, Robert, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. My question is this. For 3 years now, I've been observing two very bright, what I thought were stars, but they're red and green and white when I put my binoculars on them. One is in the eastern sky, and one is in the southwestern sky.
Mm-hmm.
They are above the cloud cover. I can't see them on a cloudy night.
What time of day?
But otherwise, I see them every night for over an hour, maybe 2 hours.
Interesting. I mean, so right now, like, the main prominent bright star that might have the effect that you're talking about is Sirius. Sirius is the brightest star in the night sky. It's going to be in the southeast, relatively low. And because it's so low in the sky, when you look at it with your eyes or through binoculars, it will have that flickering effect. And if your eyes are really good, you might even see the light kind of shimmer because it's a white star. So you're going to see the scatter of the blue and the red and all of that. The troublesome thing is that you're saying that you see it all the time, and the stars should definitely change with the season. So Sirius has been out there for the last couple of months in approximately that spot. But if you're seeing it in the summertime in the same spot, it can't
be
an astronomical object.
Could be a different star doing the same
object.
Thing, though, yeah?
Yes, it could be, for sure. But they should definitely move throughout the night and be different throughout the seasons.
I mean, Venus, if you get up, well, I think it's Venus, very early in the morning, like 5 o'clock, isn't Venus still very bright, low on the horizon?
Yeah.
And it's so brilliant.
These items I'm seeing are brighter than Venus, larger than anything else in the sky besides the moon.
Yeah.
And they are colored green, red, and white.
Yeah.
Drones.
They are not flashing. They are solid colors.
Interesting. Yeah.
And UFOs, dude.
Dying to know what they are.
I mean, it sounds like it could be a bright star that is kind of doing the scintillation, the shaking. Nope. But I'm wondering, because if you see them all the time, then it's got to be something terrestrial. It wouldn't be something in space, I don't think.
Interesting.
Could they possibly be a navigation aid for airliners?
Possibly, but not from space. You know, we're not having the airplanes communicate with satellites or anything. It's very possible you're seeing something in the distance, and maybe you don't see it on a cloudy day because it's at high elevation and you would also have fog blocking it potentially. So that could be it.
Hey, man, why don't you take a picture of it next time? Take a few. It's really tough. I mean, taking a picture in a night sky of a dot is not easy, and it doesn't give you much information. But at least we could see, okay, well, it's something. And you can email voxpop@wamc.org.
Yeah.
A lot of cool stuff down there in Brewster and Pauling and whatnot. A lot of UFO sightings down there. They might be watching you, Robert. What do you think?
I don't think so.
All right,
man. Good man.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. We're going to take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. How's about a little Clapton? Dwayne Allman there with Eric Clapton. Derek and the Dominoes, Have You Ever Loved a Woman on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. I think that was an old Freddie King hit way back when.
Yeah, it's a good 60s. Song. I'm head jamming out over here.
Oh, yeah, Derek and the Dominoes. All right, this email came in. What's your suggestion for viewing the 2027 total solar eclipse? August 2nd, 2027. If money was no object, where would you recommend going?
Well, that's a good question. I would need to be reminded where the path is for that one. My brain has been on the one in 2026, which is over in Spain.
Okay.
I'd have to take a look at the maps to see where the one in 2027 is. I don't remember off the top of my head, but somewhere along wherever totality is, that's where you should definitely be.
Mike, I'll tell you what. I'm going to recommend that Mr. Eclipse answer this one next month. So maybe send this one. Bob Berman will be back with us next month.
We'll definitely take a look at the map, and I'll have a better answer then.
Number here is 800-348-2551. This email from Michael. You've probably answered this question 100 times, but when I look at the night sky from Eagle Bridge, approximately southwest toward Albany, I see a bright light in what seems to be the same location. Can you tell me what it is? Of course, we don't know what time of day.
Right, right. It's always tricky. And what I was saying kind of to the last caller is, like, if you're seeing something bright in the sky, if it moves with the stars, it's definitely astronomical. If it's twinkling, it's a bright star. If it doesn't twinkle and moves with the stars, it's probably planets. And right now, I think, you know, Venus is in that general direction in the early evening. So it could be one of the planets. But if it's not moving, or it's there all the time year round, then it's got to be something terrestrial in the distance.
Okay, so a couple things here, and then we'll go back to the phones. Mm-hmm. The flickering. Mm-hmm. And the planets don't. And I've known this since I was a kid.
Right.
Why? The planets are still pretty far away. Mm-hmm. I presume that the flickering is coming from our atmosphere.
Yes.
On the stars. Well, the planets, some of the planets are dimmer than stars. Why wouldn't we see flickering?
Right. Well, it has to do with their distance from us and how concentrated the light is. So a star is like taking a flashlight and holding it from very far away and shining. By the time the light gets to you, it's kind of coming in at an angle. The planets are much closer and the light is coming in straight forward.
Yeah.
And it doesn't end up bouncing around as much relative to our eyes, which are looking straight up at it. It's almost like getting a bright beam of light right at your face. Whereas the starlight is coming in at a slightly higher angle and it ends up bouncing around more. And we see that as flickering. That's also why the planets tend to look a little larger than just a distinct dot, is, you know, because they're really large and you're just getting more concentrated light.
Okay, now is the second question, which has puzzled me at times, and I won't be able to enunciate it quickly, and then the show will be over, but I'll try. So, when you're looking at the sky, which I do all the time, you got a planet, maybe you got Jupiter up there, bunch of stars nearby. The relative, am I wrong, or will the relative motion of the planet be much faster? Isn't that a tip-off?
Yes, definitely. But for all the planets, you probably won't notice it moving in a single night. If you're very precise with your observations, you can for planets like Mars that are close to us, or Venus.
Yeah.
But if you watched it from, like, week to week, let's say, then you will notice that, you know, Mars will shift substantially against the background stars. That's how we figured out they were planets in the first place.
But then, so you're disabusing me of something. So then if you're watching in one night and you're watching for 6 hours, Jupiter won't appear to have moved more than the stars behind it?
Right. So Jupiter will rise and set with the stars. It is moving against the background stars, but it's such a small amount in a single night that your eyes are just not going to be able to perceive that difference. But if you look today and you look next Thursday, you might be able to see a little bit more of a difference for some of the planets.
Well, Dr. Valerie Rapson, thank you very much. Now 50 years of wrong ideas have already been
That's what I'm
shot.
Here for.
Thank
Clear
you very
up.
Much. Let's go to Orange County. Kevin, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Valerie. Hi, Ray. How you doing?
Good. Good to have you here.
Everybody's good.
Yeah.
I have just a simple question. I know there's something called star nurseries, and I know that stars die. Is the birth rate exceeding the death rate?
So we basically have about 1 to 10, we don't know the exact number, 1 to 10 stars born in our galaxy per year. And it's harder to tell the death rate within our galaxy because we see supernovas and so infrequently, and the creation of planetary nebula so infrequently. So I'm not sure that we have a great, you know, constraint on the death rate. But I think right now we are probably, this is my guess, probably forming stars a little bit more frequently than they are dying because their lifespans are just so long.
Kevin.
Yeah, like Jiffy Pop popcorn.
Yeah, exactly. It only takes, you know, 100 million years to form a star, but then it's going to live for, you know, 1 to 10 billion, so they die off a little slower.
Kevin, thanks a lot. You know, you just reminded me about the article we talked about earlier about the nebula, Ring Nebula. I think there was a thing in that article that it's only 6,000 years old.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. So this event that caused this was in...
Right, yeah, like humans could have seen it.
Amazing.
Yeah. There's a lot of planetary nebula that we see that are not that old, and there are some that, you know, were observed 1,000 years ago where we have, like, documentation of people seeing an explosion, not knowing what it is, and today we point our telescopes in that direction and we see a ring or some sort of nebula, so we can match it up, and there have been a handful that were observed by a relatively modern human race.
Are there historical astronomers?
Yeah.
Just those who look back in history and sort of figure out some of the mysteries?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's really important to do this kind of archival work where we're looking back at the old texts, the old sketches, and, you know, even looking at, you know, more modern photographs. When this asteroid came about, the first thing some astronomers did was went back into the archives, pulled out every plate they could find, and tried to see if this asteroid had been detected previously and we just didn't know it. Because then we could make a map, you know, that spans tens or hundreds of years of orbit and get a really precise measurement. But they didn't find anything, unfortunately.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Tom is in Great Barrington. Hello, Tom. You're on.
How you doing? I got a two-part question.
Okay.
Okay. How do they figure out what the window is to send the satellites or the rocket ships or NASA things out into space? And what determines that? And how come when they have these rockets or the things that go to Mars or Jupiter or whatever, how come nothing ever takes them out in space, you know, like a rock or something?
Yeah. No, those are great questions. So the answer is that there's a lot of space in space. So even between the satellites in orbit around the Earth, there's a great deal of open space for us to get there. And we're kind of less concerned about accidentally hitting a satellite on the way up as we are with planetary alignments. We want to make sure we launch at the right time so we're aimed in the right direction and we end up having enough fuel to get where we need to go. So it's a valid concern, but I think if you think about, you know, there being hundreds, if not thousands of miles between each satellite in space, then it becomes less of a worry of hitting. And these small rocks that you mentioned, they do hit things. There's tiny rocks hitting the James Webb Space Telescope all the time, but we plan for that. And we make sure that our metals and the engineering that we use on the spacecrafts can withstand some of these smaller strikes.
Tom, what's going on in the background where you are? Are you working some sort of working on cars or something? What's happening?
No, this is my truck's loud.
Yeah, all right, man. Well, the car show will be coming up next month. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Altamont and Eric. Eric, you're on.
Hi. I missed the first half of the show, so I apologize if this has come up already. But a friend of mine just reached out to me. I'm actually playing hooky on a meeting right now.
Good for you.
Excellent.
He said I should call in and mention that I've seen a very peculiar drone in the sky over the last three nights at my house and my neighbor, and et cetera. And we've called the Gilderland police and we've called the state police as well, who came out yesterday and we took a ride with them. This drone looks like a mothership in the sky that has a lot of little drones that come out of it.
You're kidding
and
me.
And fly in formations.
That's very
strange. Yeah, I'm not kidding at all. And it's, and I've been curious. Like we saw it recently and thought maybe it was like a celestial thing. So I have one of those star apps where you would point it at the light and it wasn't anything. And then we started to see the little drones coming out of it and flying across the sky.
Wow.
And my neighbor's been freaking out about it. And so we ended up calling the police.
And what'd the police say?
We drove with the state police yesterday, all the way out to Schoharie, chasing after it, and it was flying away from us. And we stopped on the side of the road and had a great discussion about how wild it was. It felt like we were in the X-Files.
All right, so did the state police see it too?
Yes, yeah. And so, I was curious if anyone else had mentioned this yet.
No, we haven't gotten a call about that specifically yet, for sure. I will say a lot of people have seen drones recently.
And there are a lot of drones.
Yeah,
they're hobbyists and everything else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They've relaxed the rules of flying after dark a little bit.
Go ahead, Eric.
This seems very odd, though, because I find that, like, when it comes to drones, right, like, I can't even find online right now a type of drone that would be a docking drone that where other drones go into it and out of it.
Yeah.
So it's got to be a military thing or something going on.
So interesting.
Yeah,
but if folks are interested, the place to look is starting around 6:30. If you're in the Gilderland area, I saw it. I could even see it from Hamilton Plaza yesterday. It's to the west and like kind of down near the horizon. You can see the light and it's a bright one.
So, is there any celestial? Hang on a second. Let's be scientific about it for a moment. Not saying what you didn't see what you say you saw.
Mm-hmm.
Valerie, is there anything in that part of the sky at that time of day?
Say which direction it was again.
I'd say it was in the low part of the sky towards the west, to maybe northwest, but probably due west.
Okay. I mean, Venus is low in the sky there. So, I mean, if you're just seeing a bright dot, and you know, most people know how to tell the difference between Venus and drones at this point now, it is there, but it will set relatively quickly. So, you know, if it doesn't go below the horizon after an hour or so, it's definitely not something celestial.
Yeah.
So. No, it sounds really interesting.
This one also,
go ahead.
Yeah, I highly recommend looking in that direction tonight.
Eric, listen, do me a favor. When you can, no rush, send me an email, as much detail as you can, including time, direction. And I have a little file that I keep on my computer about this stuff. And the fact that the state police,
you got it, Ray.
The state police were involved. So there's a level there that is not just, I saw a light in the sky.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, if you can, it's okay. Thanks, man. Appreciate the
call. I do know there's training facilities out that way for drone pilots.
Yes.
My husband has his drone license, and he flies them for safety reasons and rescue reasons. So he has done some training in that area. So it would not surprise me at all if this was, you know, a really cool piece of technology that we haven't told the world about yet that, you know, they're flying around and testing out.
I mean, the ones in Jersey kind of stopped once they said, all right, we're closing the airspace, and then they pretty much stopped. Not all of them, but a lot of them did, and then they sort of came back when they opened up the airspace a little bit.
Yeah.
You never know. Yeah. My mind is open on this, and by the way, if you're scoring at home, folks, May 7th, I believe, Kevin Knuth, physicist at UAlbany, is coming on, and we're doing a UFO show.
Fantastic.
We haven't done one in a couple of years, and he is a terrifically smart individual, so that'll be fun.
Well, Ray, speaking of cool things in the sky, I want to make sure we mention the upcoming lunar eclipse.
Right,
right.
Because
I won't be back on until this happens, so we got to tell people that on the morning of March 14th, that's a Friday, you got to get up real early because we're going to have a total lunar eclipse from about 1 a.m. to about 5 a.m. with the peak time to look at about 3 a.m.
Oh,
so,
neato.
You know, prepare to get up early, make an extra pot of coffee for the day before you go to work.
What's
but it'll
day?
Be worth it. March 14th.
So it may still be a little chilly.
Yeah, it'll definitely be cold. But the nice thing is, you know, anybody can see it. You don't need a telescope. You'll walk outside. The moon will be blood red. It'll just look so neat. So even if you get up for 5 minutes, peek out the window, and go back to bed, like, you should really get up and see it.
I love lunar eclipses. I love that red color.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any part of the world where it's less red? I mean, you figure, oh, it's an eclipse, it's going to go completely dark. But it doesn't. It's this beautiful red-orange color. Is there any spot on Earth where it's darker? The moon is darker?
No, not really, because what you're getting is the light from the sun is passing through Earth's atmosphere, and it's that little bit of red light that ends up passing through because the blue is scattered. That's why we have a blue sky. A little bit of the red makes it through, so anybody on the night side of Earth that's observing the eclipse is going to see the same amount of red light pretty much hitting the moon and giving it that blood red color. So it gets very dark until totality, and then it kind of has that reddish shimmer to it.
All right, we only have time for a couple of emails here, Valerie, and then we'll move on out of here. Here's an interesting one.
Oh.
This is, it's okay, don't panic. John writes in, I know there is a supernova that we are currently waiting for that is supposed to happen sometime, and we've talked about this fluctuation and the speculation about that. What's that star?
Well, Betelgeuse is going to go supernova, but T. Corona Borealis is the nova that we've been anxiously awaiting the last few months.
So John says, my question is, how long do they last? A few seconds, days, decades?
So if we're thinking about supernova for a second, the actual explosion happens within a few seconds. The star collapses and explodes, so the brightest flash of light will happen very quickly. We can see them in the sky with our eyes and small telescopes for at least a couple of weeks, and professional telescopes will watch them for at least a couple of months.
Really?
Yeah. So they are going to fade. You know, every night they fade, but we actually monitor how they fade, how quickly, and at what rate, and that tells us something about the progenitor star. What exactly was the size and the structure of the star before it exploded?
Now, what size star, how much mass do you need for a star at the end of its life to go supernova?
Around 8 solar masses. Bigger than that will go supernova. So,
so
it's
the
least
sun
eight
will,
times
our
the
sun
mass.
Will not. Sol,
correct.
Sol will not.
Yeah, it'll end up looking more like the Ring Nebula when it eventually dies. It'll toss the plasma out at a slower, less violent rate, and it'll create this pretty nebula around us.
All right, here's another one. We only have about 30 seconds.
Okay,
how long would it take to terraform Mars to make it habitable? That's from Michael and Reinbeck.
Too long. I don't know. I mean, I'm optimistic about our trips to Mars because I think they will be fun and exciting, but I don't know. I don't think we're ready to try and live there yet. I think we're going to have to bring all the food and water and everything we need to survive, and terraforming is a whole other ordeal.
Only 15 seconds left here, but you think people... Mars is one thing. It's mm-hmm. far away. It's a long trip. The moon is a pretty short trip. Mm-hmm. Do you think people will live on the moon in our lifetimes?
Potentially. I'm really excited for all the technology they're going to develop, at least an attempt to do this. So
yeah.
Even if we don't end up, you know, colonizing the moon, I think we'll be okay. We'll have all sorts of cool new technology to play with on Earth.
Dr. Valerie Rapson, how do people find out more about your lovely observatory and everything else over at Oneonta?
SUNY Oneonta's website.
Planetarium.
Just search for Planetarium. You can find us. We got shows on Friday and Saturday nights all semester.
But so the public can't go to the observatory?
We're going to have an event on campus for the lunar eclipse, and we'll have some open observatory nights in April or May.
I got to go to that. Yes. Hey, thanks a lot. We'll see you next month.
Yeah, sounds great.
Support comes from California Closets, Albany, serving upstate New York, working to help clients organize their homes with custom built-ins, home offices, wall beds, and more. CaliforniaClosets.com. And the New York State Kinship Navigator, providing information on health, education, financial, and legal services for children in kinship care. NYSNavigator.org. Well, thanks again to Dr. Valerie Rapson for being here. Thank you for listening. Great calls, as always. Thanks to, hey, I think it might have been his first shot here on Vox Pop, Kalen McPherson. Nicely done, sir. Thanks to Susie Chekai, who screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., it's time once again to check in with our pal, Chef Rick Orlando. He informs me the weather's cold. We'll talk about nice warming soups and stews. We'll see you at 2 p.m.